Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Kia ora, g'day, and welcome to the history of Aotearoa New Zealand. Episode 120, Te Rā, with the Early Māori Textiles Team. This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui a Tara, on the rohe of Mua Upoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Ati Awa, and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Today, I have an interview for you that, like all the interviews that I have done, is something very special. Last episode, we discussed the construction and use of wakatoa, war canoes. In that episode, we talked a little about the sails that Māori used to power their vessels, and more specifically, I mentioned the only surviving pre-European Māori sail, currently held by the British Museum. Her name is Te Rā, which in this context translates quite grandly to the sail. And she's actually not in Britain at this very moment, at least at time of release. She is in Christchurch at the Art Gallery, and will be in the Auckland Museum for 6 months in October after that. The reason I'm telling you all this is because I think it's super cool and an amazing opportunity to see a unique taonga up close. So, I reached out to the team who went through the process of getting funding, liaising with the British Museum, and then organising all the logistics. They quite kindly offered their time to chat with me about Te Rā and what the process was like bringing her home. Catherine, Rānui and Donna all exude a huge amount of passion for Te Rā, and I hope their enthusiasm for this extraordinary taonga rubs off on you. Enjoy. Yeah, let's just crack into it. So thank you very much, guys, for coming along and sharing your knowledge with us and that sort of thing. It's always awesome to have people who are willing to spend time with me and with the listeners to share their passions, the amazing work that they've done. So I guess we'll go around the room and you guys can tell us a bit about yourselves and kind of how you came to be sort of part of this project. Whoever wants to go first.
I guess it's me. Kia ora. I'm Rānui Ngāri Mai. Ngāi Tahu, Ngāti Mushunga. And I became involved with Te Rā through being on another project with Catherine at the British Museum. We had the opportunity to look at Te Rā, which we did, and felt that we needed to do something about it. That's how I got involved.
Oh, well, tēnā koutou. I'm Donna Campbell, nō ngā pohi me Ngāti Ruanui. My involvement in this project was on the invitation of Catherine and Rānui. Te Rā is a taonga I've been fascinated with for a number of years, and so it was an honour and a privilege to be invited to be part of this project. So, yep, that's me.
I'm Catherine Smith. I think it's pretty interesting that neither Rānui or Donna have mentioned that they're both very accomplished wavers. You know, obviously another big reason why we're all on this project together, and it would be impossible for this project to exist without their extensive knowledge of raranga and their interest and passion for textiles and their place in culture. But yeah, I'm a pre-contact Māori textiles researcher and textile scientist. And yeah, I've been really fortunate to get to work with both Donna and Rānui on a number of different kaupapa, and this is pretty special for all of us to get to work with Te Rā.
Amazing. Yeah, no, it definitely is something very special, very unique, I think, as well. I guess the initial question is, how did this project kind of get started? Was there a catalyst? how do you even start to think about this is what we want to do? We want to bring Te Ra back to New Zealand. How do you start with this? How do you even begin to think how you're going to approach this?
I'll tell our little story, if that's okay with you, Donna and Ranui. As Ranui mentioned, we were working on another project looking at really early kākahu that were held in collections all around the world, and we were working as part of a Royal Society of New Zealand Marsden Fund grant together. And like Ranui said, it was the last day that we were there. One of the collection managers there, Jill, asked Ranui if there was anything else you'd like to see. You know, one of those sort of throwaway questions that you think people usually might not really have something in mind. But Ranui certainly had something in mind, and she said, I'd like to see Te Ra. And I was pretty shocked when that happened, because not that many people have gotten to see Te Ra. So we were taken into a room, and Te Ra is so big, there wasn't a table that was big enough for all of Te Ra to be rolled out on. And so we saw a bit of Te Ra, and Ranui looked up at me with the most enormous smile on her face, you know, just full of joy. We were both blown away. It's a breathtaking moment, I think, seeing that kind of artistry and talent and skill to be in the presence of a Tonga of that magnitude. And over the course of that sort of half an hour, Ranui said to me, we've got to find a way to bring Te Ra home. And I'd worked with Donna previously. She was the first Māori person I worked with on any project ever. When I came to New Zealand 20 plus years ago, we worked on a project at Otago Museum together. And she, the poor thing, tried to teach me how to make raranga for a brief minute in time. And of course, Ranui has worked for many years with Donna, because Donna is a very talented weaver, and Ranui organised a very important exhibition about Māori weaving called The Eternal Thread, and they travelled to the US to get us. And also we knew that Donna had already been to see Te Ra with some of her other colleagues, and that was something she was passionate about. So I guess it's just one of those things where people with a particular kind of interest come together. Then we just sort of had to figure out how to get some money. And I don't think we ever really envisaged that we'd literally bring Te Ra home. We were trying to think about, if the British Museum burnt down tomorrow, how we could make sure that all the knowledge and understanding and technology in Te Ra could be preserved and given back to New Zealand to be made available, even though it was held in a closed storeroom at the British Museum. So that was the start of the journey. And then coming together and writing an application for Te Aparangi Royal Society Marsden Fund grant. And that's a pretty lengthy process. You know, it took us a bit of, you know, writing. You put in one application, they weed out 50% of applicants. It's pretty brutal. And then after you get through that first round, if you're lucky enough or fortunate enough, and you've written an application that's of interest, then you're invited to write a more extensive application again that takes a really long time. Then it goes to international referees, and they make comments. You get to respond or explain a bit more or clarify. Part of that is presenting budgets, outlining the kind of research process you want to go into. And then we were very fortunate to be able to ultimately get a Marsden grant. But that's a little bit like winning the lotto. So we could have done all of that work for nothing, and many, many people do. So we're very grateful for the privilege that we were given to embark on this research. And then through the process of the years that we've been doing that work, we've ultimately moved towards that idea that we could borrow Te Ra, and then went through the processes to do that.
Cool. So it started more as a theoretical coming home of how do we bring that knowledge and I guess maybe digitally bring that back, and then kind of grew from there to be like, actually we could physically bring her back. Is that kind of how that developed?
The thing is that we thought, just like Catherine said, about trying to gather all of the knowledge that Te Ra holds. Like, so for instance, the weave construction, it's highly complex. It uses the techniques used are not seen today. All of the construction of this taonga, so to try and record and document that. Also, the provenance of feathers, the textile, you know, all of that work. And also to try and think about how did Te Ra actually end up in the British Museum? So there are these different layers of information that we wanted to pull together to be able to disseminate to everyone in New Zealand. And so that was the driving force initially. And always in the back of our minds, I think all Māori researchers who are working with Tonga overseas, in the back of our minds, there's always, oh, could we bring this home? But, you know, it's not, that was there, but what we wanted to do was bring everything back about Te Rā, because we just didn't even, it was a moimoi, it was a dream for us to be able to bring Te Rā back. Rānui, you've got a little story about that. Somebody said to you, it's impossible? Or
yeah, almost impossible. When we were in the British Museum, I asked the question, what was the likelihood of Te Rā coming back to Aotearoa, New Zealand? And I was told that it was almost impossible or nearly impossible. And I thought, oh, well, that's close enough for us. You know, if it's not impossible, well, something can be done.
Yeah, as long as there's a chance, that's enough.
There's a chance.
And I guess the background to that, Thomas, a lot of people who don't work in the museum sector are probably not aware just how difficult it is to move artefacts, particularly from, you know, large international institutions. So it's a long process. It's a process of relationship building. It's a process of having the ability to communicate with those institutions in a language that they understand. It's a challenging, lengthy process. And we were really fortunate. We were supported internally at the British Museum. So, you know, we had a lot of support from the curator of Oceania, Julie Adams, because without those kinds of supports, unfortunately, it's pretty easy for those things not to come to fruition, whether or not, you know, aside from the ethics of those negotiations, that's why, you know, it was a dream, because you can never, ever be sure that you're going to be successful with those things.
Definitely. Well, you've all touched on things that I want to delve into a little bit deeper, which is awesome. So before we talk about Te Rā herself, a bit about the process of getting her here, because I find that quite interesting. So to start with, I guess, to your point about dealing with the British Museum, how do you even pitch that to an institution so old and monumentally large as the British Museum? And of course, given the reputation of the British Museum, how do you even approach that?
A pretty clear process. So anybody can do that. Mm-hmm. There's a link to a form on the website. You know, there's a committee that meets, I believe, twice a year, that assesses those applications. And obviously the structured format also involves making contact to the curatorial team that are responsible for the artefacts. But in saying that, it means that you have to have the ability to navigate the processes. You have to have the ability to navigate to find the curator of the collection that you're interested in. I'm sure they get loan requests all the time. You know, we've had a lengthy relationship. I think if the first time that we went to the British Museum, if we'd put in a loan application, it wouldn't necessarily have been successful. It's a long process of building up a relationship of trust. Do you think that's a fair thing to say, Rānui and Donna?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is. And I think it was from our first visit when we were doing that other research project. I think just building up those relationships with the staff, behaving in a way that gave the museum confidence that we knew what we were doing, we understood what we were doing, and that we were not there to create any harm or mistrust with the staff that were there at the time. So that when we did get the grant to study Te Rā, we already had a working relationship with the key people at the British Museum.
We also committed to all of our research being available for the British Museum as well, so that we were funded to find out, it was important for us that the research be available to the British Museum as well, so that it's like a reciprocal relationship. We weren't there to go and just take all this information and see you later, never see you again. You know, so we entered into a partnership with them. And that was how the relationship building needs, you know, that's how you build relationships, right? So that was always there at the outset. And so for them to give us access, for them to give us space, they knew that they would be receiving the research that we were creating as well. I think that was a big part of it too. Do you guys think that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's important to note that doesn't always sail smoothly because you've got groups of people with different priorities and understandings. And so, there's always going to be pressure points and areas for negotiation, and not necessarily everyone's going to be happy all of the time. And that's just part of this process of negotiation that happens all the time in museums and art galleries. Yeah, it's just that, keep asking, that I think Ranui's attitude of if it's almost impossible, and we didn't, you don't just put in a loan request cold. We had a lot of conversations about what was possible and what our desires and qualifications were. They knew that the kaupapa was really important to New Zealand. We had already applied to take samples from Tera to identify the plant materials and the feathers. And, I'd been told that I'd never get permission to do that. It's little steps, relationship building, understanding the benefits for not just, obviously it wasn't about benefits for the three of us. We were paid a lot of money by, the people of New Zealand to do this work. So knowing that the goal for the gathering the information is to provide access to the ability to understand Te Ra to as many people as possible. And that's a really important argument to make the exhibition, because we could put up, we're still working on making our information publicly available, because a lot of it's really large information, like digital information, like the images. Things like diagrams of weave, those things were in process. You can't deny that more people from more different walks of life will ever get access to the information about an artefact outside of an exhibition environment. So, instead of just having information for weavers or people who are interested in the botany and zoology of New Zealand or people who are interested in sailing, once you throw an exhibition up, you've got school kids, you've got people who just happen to be coming to an art gallery in Christchurch. So it provides that public access in a way that a lot of research doesn't. So that's a really strong argument for those kinds of things.
Yeah, that really quite speaks to me a little bit, because I'm sort of one of those people that when you go see it in person, it's different. It's different than seeing the pictures on the website. So for me, it was like, it's, we can get these things over here. We can see them in person. That's exciting for me as someone who's just interested in history and really enjoys that and wants to learn more, is just seeing these in person is so much. You get so much more. There's so much more that you can see, you can feel, even though you can't touch it. It's hard to describe to people sometimes.
Very, very powerful.
Yeah, and before the exhibition, one of the key things for us was that we have some community engagement with this taonga. So before before Te Ra was mounted, we had a three-day, we called it a wānanga, and invited people to actually come and touch this taonga. Touch, take pictures, waiata, sing songs. Have to be in the space with this fascinating taonga, which is just like, even just going into the back of a gallery or a museum is quite exciting just in itself, but then to be able to go right up to a taonga, touch it, feel it with no gloves on, take as many pictures as you like, and to talk about, we had so many awesome conversations about how, people's reflections on the use of Te Ra, like the just all these amazing conversations with people. And, for us as researchers, that was incredibly fruitful. And for the gallery and for the people that came to visit, it would have been, we've had feedback that it was just an incredible experience to be able to be so close to something as special as that. And we could have just had an exhibition and then that's it, have the exhibition. But then, like you say, Catherine, and you added to Thomas, to be able to touch something, to be able to be right there with this take photos, and it was just a one in once in a kind of once in a lifetime experience.
I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about digital repatriation, and I think it really misses the point, because being in the presence of taonga, time collapses. It's a different mode of connection. It's powerful. It's tangibly powerful, emotional taonga. You don't get that from a picture. And it belies the notion that digital repatriation is a way of getting access to taonga.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess to slightly delve a little deeper into that sort of thing, what I guess for you guys personally, was there sort of difficulty reconciling the fact that you have to deal with the British Museum, which is an institution with a particular reputation? Was there difficulty reconciling the fact that you were sort of not necessarily becoming part of the system, but having to interact with the system that has not been super great for Aotearoa?
Well, you know, if you don't... Oh, sorry, you go, Rānui.
No,
oh,
you go. Okay.
Well, you know, Thomas, you know, if we want to change the system, sometimes we have to engage with it, right? So, you know, you can't stand outside the hierarchies of power and just throw stones, because nothing is going to happen. So for us to engage, we need to engage with these systems in order to shift the thinking. And I really believe that this project, that we have made a major shift in the thinking of the curators at the British Museum. And because, you know, we have a beautiful queer on our project who is really very rangi Māori. I mean, I don't even have the words in English, really. She's just such a beautiful way of communicating with people. And so having Rānui on the project has made, you know, that's been majorly significant in terms of what we've been able to achieve. Because
I
of
agree.
Her, yeah, because of the way that she is. And so I'm sorry to talk about you, Rānui, like you're not there, but, you know. Yeah, but because of that, having that, her being able to clear those pathways for us, you know, like us young radicals, me and Catherine, who want to throw stones at the system. But anyway, you can cut
all
that.
You know, we've seen that all around the world. Rānui is the best ambassador, and every time we go somewhere, all of the busyness and the difficulty of providing access and how annoying it is to have researchers when you've got exhibition programs, all that falls away because of Rānui's mana and wairua and her attitude to the people who are doing their best in institutional context. And we're talking about people who don't really understand the importance of the taonga they care for to the people that the taonga belongs to. And this happened, you know, again and again, trying to make it clear to people who have never been to New Zealand, and I'm not talking about Julie, the curator at the British Museum here, because she's a different kettle of fish, because she's spent a lot of time in Aotearoa. But, you know, most people who work in European cultural institutions care for taonga that is from places they've never been to, and they don't think about they don't have a mechanism philosophically to understand just how deeply important it is to be in the presence of the humans that belong to that taonga and that the taonga belongs to. It's a tricky, you know, how do you talk about this stuff? How do you show people? I believe the way you show people is to bring them to New Zealand and stick them in a room full of people who are talking to their ancestor.
Yeah, which is what that wānanga did, you know, that 3 days before the, to see people engage with this taonga as an ancestor. You have to be there, you know. So that's what I mean about, I think that we've shifted. We wouldn't have had to shift, you know, Julie's thinking, but she will take back her experience and she'll share that experience. So, yeah.
Amazing. So hopefully we might see more projects like this in the future, fingers crossed.
People are doing this work all the time, Thomas. People, there's so many people behind the scenes working tirelessly from New Zealand. The Te Papa repatriation team, you know, these people are doing this mahi tirelessly on behalf of their people. And yeah, I agree. You know, hopefully it'll be easier for people who come after us to do these things, but there's so many people who have worked tirelessly their whole careers for this kind of work already.
Yeah, I got to speak to the manager of the repatriation team at Te Papa in a previous episode. Not so subtle plug, listeners, if you want to listen to that episode. But yes, I have spoken to them previously, which was amazing. So yeah, no, there's definitely lots of people, doing all sorts of amazing work for this sort of stuff. So I guess in terms of the timeline, you convince the British Museum that this is a good thing that they should be doing, and they say, yep, that's pretty cool, we'll do it. What sort of arrangements do you need to make to get Tara to, or back to Aotearoa? I guess I'm right in assuming that you don't just chuck her in a suitcase, put her on a plane, and away we go. I assume she's quite delicate, needs specific packing arrangements. What do those arrangements look like?
Well, the British Museum, they made a crate for Tara. The crate was huge. It weighed 276 kilograms, and Tara weighs less than 5 kilograms. So you can imagine how strong and robust that crate was. And Tara was very carefully packed and secured within the crate to ensure that there was no movement of the tonga inside of the crate from the time it left the British Museum to the time it arrived at the Christchurch City Art Gallery. And yeah, it's pretty impressive. And Joe Harawira from Ngāti Awa and myself went over to bring Tara home. Now, the reason why Joe and I went was because Joe's he's the chair of the Āwhi Tikanga Committee for Toi Māori Aotearoa. So Joe and I went over at the request of Ngāi Tua Huriri, who's the local mana whenua here in Christchurch. And Joe and I carried out the rituals at the British Museum to prepare Tara for packaging. And then we escorted it home every step of the way from the British Museum in the truck to the Heathrow loading bay, where we were allowed to go in and watch it being packed and loaded up onto the plane. And then when we got to Singapore, dashing from one place to another to see it come off one plane and then go on to another plane to when it arrived at Christchurch. And we have had with us a conservator from the British Museum who also undertook these little efforts of running from one terminal to another to see it unloaded and reloaded. So that was the physical part of getting it here to Aotearoa. And when it arrived, it was greeted by mana whenua, Ngāi Tua Huriri, at the loading bay at Christchurch Airport. And after they had carried out their tikanga, it was taken to the art gallery where we all met up with it and had another little ceremony for arrival. And from there it was rested for 24 hours before it was unpacked. And then, as Donna said, we had to be prepared for a three-day wānanga, which was just fabulous for everybody who came, as well as the staff at the Christchurch Art Gallery. I enjoyed it too.
Amazing to move from the process of getting her here more into talking about Tara herself. We've talked a little bit about why she's significant, but I guess to really dive into that, why is Tara significant? Why did you guys go to all this effort to bring her back to New Zealand and all that sort of stuff?
Well,
how long we got?
Hey, Donna.
So as far as we know, Tara is the only known waka sail of this type in existence. And so first off, that's hugely significant. And, you know, like what's really exciting about the exposure that Tara has had and will still have is that perhaps other museums may discover that they have other textiles that are very similar. And or they wrap, you know, whatever they are, they think they're mats or whatever. But they could be sales. So how exciting would that be that, you know, other taonga like this are lying around in European museums? So also, you know, the significance of, as I mentioned before, is about the construction. The weave is very, very intricate and complex. The strands that are woven are very fine. The attachment of the feathers, like everything is so incredibly fascinating about this taonga. The attachment of the feathers, where they're attached, why they're there. There's a piece that it's called the awama. What's it called? The matairangi.
Matairangi.
The pennant that hangs from the side that has feathers on it. It has triangles on the top and on the bottom, little woven triangles, feathers attached across the top. It is 13 panels that are woven together, you know. And when we weave panels together, we're replacing one strand at a time. You know, we're not putting the panels together and sewing them together. So that joining process is incredibly amazing. Two weavers. Actually, it's incredibly strong in the first instance. It's really, we don't see that being used today. And then the zigzag openings that run vertically along the textile, they are also an intricate pattern. And very excitingly, technically, the voids that are running up the sail, the pattern is not interrupted in the joining of the panels together. It's kind of difficult to describe that in terms of the technical way of weaving the panels together without kind of interrupting the join, but also not interrupting the void, you know, because we have talked with sailors about the voids or the openings are to allow the wind to move through. So if you can think about if we join the panels, but at every section where the panels join, the voids are closed, you know, so then that would make the wind operate in a different way. So the genius of our tūpuna worked out that we need to have the voids open all the way in order for the wind to control the wind in a certain direction or a certain way. The significance really, one of the big things for me about this taonga is that we can look at it and think about how highly technical it is and the wealth and breadth of knowledge it would have taken to create these sails of this type, you know, and to make them work. So it's really about tūpuna genius. That's what
genius.
I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. It when you look at Tara, it's the physical embodiment of mastery. It's of mastery of navigation and sailing. It's of mastery of new plants coming to our Aotearoa, understanding those plants, cultivating those plants, harvesting those plants. And then it's absolute technical mastery of weaving, form and function, technical virtuosity, extraordinary understanding of the environment, both on Aotearoa and off it on the water, all brought together in a way that, you know, technically wasn't practiced after that point. So with all the reinvigoration of understanding about navigation and traditional voyaging and bringing waka back onto the oceans, the missing link is the sails that we used on those waka. And, yeah. You know, just by chance, we have one to look at. And it took a long time for people to understand what it was sitting in the basement at the British Museum, and then longer for Māori people to get to see the brilliance of their ancestors, you know. So it's a journey too of rediscovery of awesome. That brilliance of from all of those aspects.
Absolutely. So do we know how she got to Britain, or is that a bit of a mystery? In terms of, you mentioned that kind of it turned up in the basement of the British Museum. But do we know, obviously it was in Aotearoa at some point, and then at some point it wasn't, and was then got to Britain. Do we know what that sort of missing link is?
No, we don't. There is nothing yet that we've discovered that tells us the story of Te Rā. There are some theories out there, but there's no evidence yet of how Te Rā got to the British Museum from here. There's some assumptions as well, of course, that it was Cook, but there's no evidence, no written evidence. There's nothing that they've recorded that tells us how it got there and who took it there.
Mm. Yeah, because that was part of the theory that I saw. Sorry, I was just going to say, the theory that I saw was Cook took it over and then it was handed over from the Admiralty to the museum, and so that's I think that's where that assumption comes from, is because the Admiralty had it at some point, and then that was they gifted it. No,
so we're part of the process. So Donna's mentions many of the aspects of the Marsden funding. There was understanding the weave construction and doing all that technical drill down, try to figure out how the weave works. There was identification of materials. There was digitization in the sense of using some very sophisticated imaging to capture Te Rā, and another big wing of the project was provenance. So a number of researchers did research, and including in and at the British Museum, there's nowhere in any of the records, including those of the Admiralty, is written down that there was a sale. And there is also information. So it's very hard to pinpoint the first time Te Rā was seen in the collection, and it probably was around, the first actual evidence is at the turn of the 20th century, where there's Hamilton shows a picture of Te Rā. But, you know, there's all sorts of, a newspaper article says that it was wrapped around other things and was discovered that it was a sail. But there is no actual evidence that the Admiralty gave a large collection to the British Museum, but the sail is not mentioned. Banks gave a large collection to the British Museum. Cook has been used as a catchphrase, really, for 18th century early contact, rather than there actually being any provenance evidence that it was Cook or any specific European visitor. One of the lovely ideas that's come up, and that this is ideas come from Julie, is that it would make sense if it was part of Topaya's collection. When Topaya passed away, all of his amazing things that he'd been gifted on his journeys with Cook were given to Banks. And that would explain why there was no written documentation necessarily. So that's, an idea. They get, as Rā Nui says, there's no firm evidence. There's been hours and hours and hours and hours of really, really detailed provenance research. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
That's not uncommon, you know. Some museums still don't have a full catalogue of their collections. The British Museum is packed to the gunwales with lots of stuff, and lots of stuff doesn't have provenance. This is not unusual. A large part of Te Papa's Kākahu collection does not have provenance. You know, the British Museum is the only storehouse without information about how they got it. It's really sad.
Mm. Yeah. So to go even further back into that provenance, Do we know where Te Rā is from in Aotearoa? Do we know what region she is from? Or is that also mysterious?
Because we don't know where Te Rā was taken from or collected from or gifted from. Science is getting to the point where we could identify where the harakeke that Te Rā is made of could tell us where that's from. Harakeke, like all weaving materials, was traded. So we would be able to identify where the harakeke was grown, but we wouldn't necessarily be identifying where it was traded from. I think that's, is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. That was going to be my next question was, looking at the plants, do we know, would that help us? But yeah, it's interesting that it wouldn't, I guess it would give us something, but not necessarily something terribly firm in that regard, which is quite interesting. Talking about harakeke, what materials is Te Rā made from? So obviously harakeke, are there any others that feature prominently in her construction?
No. The body of the sail is harakeke. It's adorned with kereru feathers, with some kahu feathers included, and it's also got kaka feathers and a bit of dog skin on it. But in the main, it's harakeke and harakeke fibre, which is muka or fito.
Awesome. You also mentioned a bit earlier that Te Rā is quite large. How large are we talking? Because the photos don't quite really illustrate the size too much. So I was wondering if you'd be able to give some vague measurements of how big are we actually talking.
It's just over 4 meters. It's almost 5 meters in height. And how wide is it, Catherine? Is at the top at its widest point? I can't remember.
Desperately trying to remember the dimensions.
That's why I said vague. Because you don't have the number, that's fine.
It's quite deceiving. When it's lying flat, does not look big at all. But when it's upright, it is quite tall. And you got to remember, it's a utility. It was made for a purpose. So it's to suit the waka that it was built for.
It's hard to, you have to use a lot of tables to unroll Te Rā. And it's a large elongated triangular shape, nearly 5 metres high, and with a large streamer on one side, a mātairangi, which is feathered as well. It's big. It's a big textile. If you look at the width of the whenū, the individual weaving elements, which are really, really fine, that there's a lot of very, very accomplished weaving to make 13 papa, 13 panels across Te Rā, and each of the joins as a triple join with that void pattern, awa matangi, that Donna was speaking of, that runs across all of those joins all the way from the top to the bottom. It's extraordinary.
So do we know maybe how long this might have taken to accomplish? Are we talking like months, years? Do we have an estimate?
No. We can speculate. How long is a piece of string? That's what the question is. And how many people worked on it, and what was the environment like, and what was life like then? Yeah, so we can figure out how long it would take to make one now, of course. But, no.
Yeah, definitely.
A lot of no answers for you, Thomas.
That's
so you've got to harvest all the materials. You've got to harvest all the materials, gather all the feathers. Prepare the feathers. The feathers are prepared as well because they're notched and split along the vein. You've got to make all the rope. There's lots of work.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So due to Te Rā's size, do we know, I guess, if Te Rā is complete or whether she is missing anything?
Te Rā's complete.
Yeah. Amazing. Brilliant. Amazing. That was the answer I was hoping for.
Yeah, it is a complete sail. It would require more cordage to attach it to be used. It would need more cordage to attach it to the Rākau, but it is a complete sail.
Awesome. So to that end, has she sustained much damage over the years? Because one thing that I did find, I understand she has had a cloth backing sewn onto her, which is not that I see Catherine shaking her head. No?
No.
Okay, that might have been from a dubious source.
So in the past, Tedar's been on exhibition once. So in the past, when it was on exhibition at the British Museum, and you can see those photos on their website, along the back of Tedar, across the hickey, across the joints, they've sewn these blue sleeves that a mounting system previously went through across several of the papa. We were fortunate enough to request those be removed before we went to examine Tedar, because of course those areas, you really need to see those areas for weavers to understand how it was made. It's like covering up the most important bits of the structure. So they've been removed. So Tedar has no fabric backing, and only previously it had some little sleeves across some structural areas for display. So no fabric backing. There's a couple of repairs. So some conservation department repairs done with Japanese tissue and adhesive. They kind of mimic the fennu. So they're just adhered to individual fennu that have splits, and then they have been in paint to tone. They're really visible, and they're also reversible, which is a conservation of cultural material, not your kind of conservation, my kind of conservation. It's a rule, I guess, a principle, an ethical imperative to only intervene if it's fully reversible. So those repairs can be removed tomorrow without any harm to Tedar. They're just providing some structural support. The British Museum, part of the prep about bringing Tedar over again means that the British Museum and two Māori conservators who we were able to secure funding to send over to be involved in bringing Tedar over and installing Tedar part of our team. Donna was very successful in gaining some funding to make sure that they assisted. Some repairs were made to Tedar to strengthen areas of weakness before Tedar came over as well. So they're the only things. There's also another repair that looks like it was done. It was definitely done sometime during its tenure at the British Museum. I'm testing the fibres to check that that's non-New Zealand plant material repair. I think it's made with European materials. And it's kind of like a darn, a very small area of Tedar. Most of Tedar is 100% original, 100% untouched, 100% non-intervened with. I'd say about 2% of Tedar has some minor repairs to it.
Amazing. I think that for me, that's quite, even makes it more special in the sense that those sorts of things, you know, I guess for the age of Tedar, you would necessarily expect a lot of conservation, or at least some conservation, significant conservation, to have been done. So the fact that it hasn't, I think, really makes it even more special and amazing.
Totally.
So I guess to be a bit more broad, how much do we actually know about pre-European Māori sails in general, in terms of their construction, design, and how they were used? Do we know a lot about them, or is there quite a bunch of information missing there?
Well, I don't know anything about them, actually, and that's why I was interested in Tedar.
We've got, you know, one of our researchers, Ross Kalman, did a lot of research into te reo Māori terms for sailing and words associated with sailing. So there's kupu. We have depictions of sails after European visitors came. So there's a lot of really famous drawings. And in those drawings, you can see images of sails that look like Tedar. If you look at the Isaac Gilsomans depiction of Abel Tasman's arrival in New Zealand, if you zoom into that image really carefully alongside the big waka, you can see a ra on a waka, and it looks like Tedar. There are a lot of depictions of sails that indicate that Tedar was pretty normal and not out of the ordinary when European people first came to Aotearoa. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, from what we know of customary Māori sails, there are two different types of them. There could have been more, but Tedar is one of the types. And then quite a lot of people have done research about different sails around the Pacific. There's an amazing book called Waka Moana that shows, you know, some really interesting analyses of how those sails changed across the Pacific. And the British Museum has two sails from Hawaii.
And Tahiti, yeah.
Tahiti. Not Hawaii. So, yeah, there's very few surviving 18th century sails, and we believe that Tedar is one of three that we know of two from Tahiti at the British Museum and Te Ra, and we're hoping that some fabulous museum in Germany will ring us up in 2 days' time and say, oh, my God, we thought they were from the Maldives, or we thought it was a large mat, because everybody seems to think big woven things are mats.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just because you mentioned Charles Mintz, I've actually got a book all about him that I've been reading, so I was flicking through that to see if I could find the picture that you were talking about. But I don't think it's in that book.
Just do a Google search on Isaac Gilsomen. Abel Tasman, and the picture's really famous and it'll come up.
Yeah, definitely. So I've only got a few more questions. So we've talked a bit about, I guess, what we have learned from today in terms of like the weaving and that sort of thing. Is there any perhaps thoughts or theories that you guys have of what else she might be able to tell us? I realize that's a bit sort of, I guess, a bit airy-fairy to get you to predict what we don't know, but do you have any predictions on maybe what we don't know and what she might be able to tell us?
Well, one of those things will be how that type of sail was used. If we can, you know, work with sailors and navigators to figure out how exactly, you know, so that's one of the, you know, one of the big things. And then to through that process of exploration, to understand what the role of the feathers and the role of the triangle pieces, you know, so there's still a lot of information that Te Ra can give us, but what we've done as much as we can in the context that we've been working in. So then we move Te Ra into the next phase, you know, into the next context, and then what's possible. And also that Te Ra can be used as a template to innovate and create new types of woven sails. And just going back to what Catherine said, you know, the missing link for contemporary waka is woven sails. And so, you know, here we have Te Ra as the template, as the original instructions, right? And so there's still so much more that we can learn from this taonga. Yeah, so much more.
Met a really sweet young man and said, what did you think of the exhibition? And he said, it was great. I'm going to go and make one. That's the first...
That's cool.
Response. Like, that's what it's all about, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I guess that was going to be my next thing, was does that mean maybe a recreation that can be used to test and that sort of thing? Is that maybe on the horizon at some point?
Yeah, a group called Te Ra Ringaropa have already made a sail. So Pete, that process of weaving a ra has been happening. They've done beautiful work. They're going around the motu, working on marae with weavers, teaching them how to weave the pattern. So, you know, the work that they're doing to teach weavers and to get people weaving is amazing. And I think there's certainly a lot of interest in people working on doing that and sticking a sail on a waka. I think that's pretty much the end goal, right? Give it a go.
Awesome. So Te Ra is here in New Zealand temporarily. Presumably she will need to be returned to the British Museum. Is there any thoughts, plans, potential that she may be able to remain in New Zealand permanently or go back to the British Museum and then come back permanently?
I love that everyone says that. I love that everyone, like, you know, everyone who came to the Wānanga, everybody, and it's actually, you know, the big thing is Te Ra is here now. And so we can, you know, that's he, Te Mea Nui, kia tātou katoa, is Te Ra is here right now. And we will, you know, who knows what's going to happen next. And so
we do know that it's going on to Auckland Museum after our Christchurch Art Gallery. So that's an important thing to remember. So after Te Ra's exhibition finishes at Christchurch Art Gallery, there's another 6 months in Tamaki. So everybody should, if they haven't already come to Christchurch Art Gallery to see Te Ra, they should get their whānau and get up to Auckland and make sure that they get to be with Te Ra.
Awesome.
Bye, Catherine.
So for the listeners, just to make that super clear, Te Ra is in the Christchurch Art Gallery until, is it October of 2023, I think?
End of October, yeah.
End of October, yeah. And then after that, she will be in the Auckland Museum for the 6 months after that. So I'm asking this entirely selfishly because I can't make it to Christchurch or Auckland. What about Wellington?
What about
Well, who
Wellington?
knows, Thomas? Who knows? You know, anything can happen. Like, you know, when you're told something's almost impossible, there's always a chance.
Absolutely. Well, that'd be my vote. Bring it to Wellington, please, because I can't make it to Auckland or Christchurch in the next 6 months.
You never know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. The last question that I have for you guys is something that I ask everyone that comes onto the podcast, because I think it's a very interesting question that yields some very interesting answers, is what's been your favorite part of working on this project? If you had to pick something, what's been the best bit, which I realize might be a difficult question.
Really easy for me, getting to work with Ranui and Donna.
I was just going to say that too. You're being part of a really amazing team.
Yeah, that's my thought too. I think that through working the way we have over, well, since 2016, 17, started out on this project, I think we dreamed a dream and we've achieved it. And Te Rā is here in Aotearoa. And even though it's on loan and we have promised to take it back to the British Museum, the important thing is that it is here and people have the opportunity to go and see it. So make the most of it while it's here at home.
With all the ups and downs and the swings and roundabouts, one of the things that Ranui has always said all along is keep your mind on the kaupapa, and the kaupapa is Te Rā, and Te Rā's been a guiding force in all of this as well, thus working together to make this happen. And it's pretty nice feeling walking into that exhibition space with Te Rā, being with Te Rā in Aotearoa. It's pretty special being all together doing that.
And I think the other thing for me is for Aotearoa to remember that Te Rā belongs to all of us. It belongs to all of us here in Aotearoa. So go see your taonga.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a pretty good note to end on. So thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak with me and to share your knowledge with myself and with my listeners. I'm sure they will very much appreciate it as much as I have. So thank you very much again.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thanks, Thomas. It's been, thank you so much for having us. Yeah.
A massive thank you once again to Catherine, Ranui and Donna for taking the time to speak with me and share their knowledge with all of us. I also want to thank all of those mentioned in the episode and those who weren't that played their part in bringing Te Rā home. Even if she is only here for a short stay, she is here now. So take the opportunity to see her while you can. Te Rā is part of your history, of those who came before us. You don't often get such an amazing gateway into the past than something made by their hands. If you want to send me feedback, ask a question, suggest a topic, or just have a chinwag, you can find my email and social media on historyaotearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt AOTEAROA. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts, sources, and translations for some of the Te Reo Māori we have used. You can help support Hans through Patreon, buying merch, or giving us a review. It means a lot, and helps spread the story of Aotearoa New Zealand. As always, haere tū atu, hoki tū mai. See you next time.